Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host Akiko Katayama, a food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberto's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I'll try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. My guest today is Richie Nakano, who is a chef based in San Francisco and a former chef and founder of Happa Ramen that was known for unique and umami-rich delicious ramen. So today we'll talk about how Richie got into ramen, his philosophy about ramen, his creative ramen recipes, and much, much more. But quickly before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website as well as on iTunes and Stitcher as podcasts. Please go to iTunes and Stitcher and subscribe to Japan Eats. Now let's start our conversation with Richie Nakano. Hello, Richie. Welcome to Japan Eats.
Hi, Akiko. Thank you for having me.
So first of all, you are half American, half Japanese. So where and how did you grow up? Did you eat a lot of Japanese food?
I did. My grandfather was actually a chef. He had a Japanese restaurant, a teppanyaki restaurant.
Wow.
And that definitely influenced a lot of my eating growing up. My dad was not a chef, but he knew how to cook really well.
Mm.
And then also my mom is a great cook. So food is pretty important in our household.
Mm.
I was born in Virginia, but then we grew up in California. So we always had like a garden going in the backyard.
Wow.
And and I was taught from a pretty young age some very basic recipes, like how to make like miso, wow, teriyaki, and things like that.
Mm. So your father's side is Japanese, mm-hmm, and mother's side more American.
Right.
So what is your favorite Japanese flavor when you grew up?
I mean, the most comforting thing that we would eat would be like my dad grilling teriyaki chicken and just having that with rice.
Mm.
Anytime that we would see my grandfather, he would take us fishing, and then he would panko crust fish and then fry it for us.
Wow.
And that was always really fun too.
You're spoiled.
Yeah.
So what inspired you to become a chef?
I was working in restaurants already in the front of house. Just, I thought it was sort of like a temporary stop on the way to going to college or something like that.
Mm.
And then I just got caught up in it. I was cooking at home a lot, and then I just realized that I should take the next step and try cooking professionally. It's the least romantic story about how you started cooking.
Mm.
But I ended up going to school for it, and I really connected with it, and so I just kept doing it.
Mm. So you went to school in California?
In San Francisco, yeah. I went to the CCA, which isn't there anymore. I went to this really old campus that was in sort of like a dingy part of town, and like my car would get broken into all the time.
Right. You survived.
Yeah, I made it through.
Right. And I heard that you worked at many different kinds of restaurants, including sushi, French bistro, local and sustainable New American restaurant. So why did you cook different kinds of food?
When I got started, I thought that I just wanted to cook Japanese food. And then pretty early in my career, I went to work for a chef who was from Hawaii, so he had a lot of Japanese flavors, a lot of Hawaiian flavors, and he was Filipino, so he brought just like this sort of pan-Asian thing to the table. But then all of his training was in French cooking. So from an early start, I got a big cross-section of knowledge about flavors and techniques and things like that.
Mm.
And so when I got done working for him, I wanted to go get away from Japanese food and Asian food for a little while and do something different. So that's when I went to NOPA and doing like more Mediterranean stuff.
Mm.
And that's where I came to really know like ingredients and sustainability and vegetables and things like that.
Right. So suddenly you got to know you haven't seen before.
Yeah. Yeah. And when I went there, it was sort of, I was honestly like kind of like rebelling against what I had been doing for my whole career, because it had been so Asian forward. And so going there, I was like, I don't want to cook with soy sauce anymore. And then it's funny because like at the end of working there, I was really hungry to get back to working with Asian flavors because I'd been away from it for so long.
So this really needed a break.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like I felt like I was being like a rebellious teenager, you know, and like I kind of like had that moment for a little while and then I came back to it later on.
Right. Because it's a part of your nature, your palate.
Yeah. I missed it. You know, I missed it a lot.
Right. Okay. And in 2010, you opened a Hapa Ramen pop-up food stand at the Ferry Plaza Farmers Market in San Francisco. And why did you open a ramen shop?
At that time, San Francisco was going through like a really interesting phase where a lot of people were moving away from traditional restaurants and doing things like pop-ups or stands at farmers markets, underground dinners, things like that.
Like
that
was, Mission Chinese,
exactly.
Starting from Mission Chinese, kind of.
So I didn't have the money to open a full-scale restaurant at that time, but I knew that I wanted to do my own thing. And at the same time, I was eating a lot of ramen around San Francisco and South Bay and the peninsula. And I was very inspired by actually Saimin, which is, you know, similar to ramen, but it's like a seafood-based stock, dashi-heavy, but it still has chashu in it and noodles and everything. And so I started working on a recipe to make that at home.
So that's originated from, not from a Japanese style, but more like Chinese style?
Right, right. But that's what I would eat when I was in Hawaii, you know? And so it was the inspiration from eating that. And honestly, like the broth in Saimin is so much lighter than many types of ramen broth. You know, it's like the polar opposite of like a tonkotsu.
Which is rich and heavy,
right,
and meaty.
Yeah.
Right.
So I just started cooking a lot. And then I realized that there was a big part of the market that was missing in terms of doing anything different with ramen or doing ramen with like better quality ingredients, you know.
I'm curious though that I think as far as I understand, ramen boom started when in New York when 2004 David Chang opened Momofuku noodle bar. And before that there are ramen shops for Japanese expatriates and for a long time, but then nobody's really taking it seriously. So and then Ippudo came from Japan and you know, other Setagaya opened, and all those, you know, like a domino effect.
Yeah.
But how did it start in San Francisco, the kind of ramen boom?
I mean, there was probably like four or five ramen places when I started. And they're all very traditional. And all of them are still around today. And, you know, they were around for a couple of years before I got into it.
So they buy Japanese chefs?
Yeah. But they're all like only... God, I want to say like two of them are just straight up ramen shops. You know, the other ones have like a little sushi counter. They do like other izakaya stuff, right?
Like Asian restaurant.
Right, right. And then I came to realize that a lot of those places were buying just like soup base, you know, and that was like, and ramen was the thing on their menu, but they weren't actually like making stock and things like that. So we started up, and then after us, like a pretty good amount of restaurants started like rolling along, you know, places came in from Japan. Other people opened up places that were similar to like what we were doing, trying to use like better ingredients and things like that and make everything from scratch. So,
Right. Sounds like better ingredients. Of course, it's California. You have better fresh ingredients.
Right, right. And just instead of putting the same stuff in every single bowl, kind of like rotating them throughout the seasons and everything.
Okay. So, sounds like the whole ramen boom spread throughout the country, but then it's very American. You have to come up with something completely new.
Yeah, I mean, like after David Chang opened Momofuku, it like didn't spread to San Francisco, strangely. I feel like LA was way ahead of us in terms of like ramen culture and shops and places like that, you know? Because by the time when I was starting Hapa, like there was still not much to eat in the Bay Area, you know, like you had to go as far south as San Jose to get like a really good bowl of ramen.
Right. Interesting. I mean, in, you know, Midwest or West at the South, they all started to have ramen shops.
Right.
So
right.
I thought San Francisco's one of the first.
Yeah. Strangely, we were pretty far behind like everyone else, you know.
Because we really had good food.
Yeah.
Right. So, so what was so special about ramen for you? It could have been, I don't know, like a burrito or some other interesting creative food, right?
I think that it brought together a lot of things that I like doing in like French restaurants or like Anopa, places like that, which were, I love making noodles, making pasta, things like that. Mm-hmm. I loved butchery. Mm-hmm. So I got to use, you know, whole animals to make the ramen at Hapa. And then I love making sauces and stocks mm-hmm. and things like that. So it combined a lot of different techniques into one dish, mm. you know.
So it's like a white canvas. You can just put almost anything right. into whatever you come up with.
Right. And you can make it as like elegant and light or as like rich and heavy as you want to. It's like there's a lot of leeway mm. in that one dish. You
right.
know?
Especially with your diverse background of cooking.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really fun to just kind of like play around. I mean, like we had one stock that we would serve at the market. Mm. It was called the Hapa Ramen Broth. But that broth went through probably like 16 different versions as we went through.
Wow.
And like every couple months, me and my cooks would stand there in front of this giant chalkboard and like draw out like how we were doing the stock and what we think we should do differently. Mm. What was working, what wasn't working. And so we constantly try to like tweak it and make it better and better and better and better.
Wow. So what's the final version?
The final version, I mean, we went through times where we were doing you know, a lot of chicken in the broth. We had times we were doing like just pork necks in there. We had times we were doing like a ton of trotters in there to get like a lot of collagen and fat. Mm. What we ended up coming up with was just pork necks and chicken feet was sort of like the main basis of it. And then we would take onions, garlic, cook those in like a really hot rondo with sesame seed oil until they were like charred and like melted down, like really a ton of color on them. And then we would deglaze that with a little bit of shoyu, mirin, sake. Mm. We would cook that down, and that would become the basis for the tare. Mm. And then we basically would cook the stock down until it got pretty tonkotsu-ish. Like, it looked pretty cloudy and, like, and it was pretty rich. But then we would thin that down with the tare. Mm. And so you would get this, like, sort of tonkotsu shoyu like hybrid, and then it got seasoned with salt on top of that, so you kind of hit like all three of like shiyu, shoyu, tonkotsu like all in one bowl.
Right. And also the chicken flavor, what does it do to the taste?
You know, the chicken feet don't have a ton of flavor, but they add a lot of just, you know, collagen and richness and a lot of body to the stock.
Right.
So it was still pretty like pork forward, the bowl, but we did offer a bowl that had little fried chicken nuggets in it along with the chashu. So we try to like have all the flavors sort of represented in the stock.
So it's kind of compatible.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, but we tweaked that broth so many times, but then we would do ones that were just strictly pork broth or that were strictly chicken broth. And we would do ones, we did beef broth even at one point, which is not traditional.
Right.
Yeah. And the people that liked Hapa Ramen like loved us for that. But then there were people that would come and they wanted very rigid shoyu, shio, tonkotsu, you know, flavor profiles, and they couldn't get that with us, and they would, you know, they hated it.
Right. Well, I'm curious, so how does the beef stock taste like in ramen?
I mean, you can't really reduce down a beef stock to make it super rich. It just turns into like beef jus, you know? So it was a thinner style broth. And we would really like roast the bones really heavily, and it could take on a lot more of the onions and the garlic and the tare in it, to sort of like lift the flavor profile. You even had to like get you, we would go heavier on sake and mirin to sort of raise the sweetness up. Otherwise it would just be this like super roasty, like salty broth, you know? So, balancing with that sweetness was like a really big thing for us.
Right.
But it was great. You know?
Well, because the other day I made a beef broth with like really like a huge knuckles. And compared to chicken broth, it's so much collagen.
Yeah.
It's like a gelatin.
Yeah, it's rich.
Right.
It's rich. And we would try to cut that with the sweetness, try to like elevate that. And then also we would always put something spicy in there to kind of cut across it also.
Right. And with the beef beef soup, what's the topping to pair with?
For that one, we did short rib.
Wow.
Yeah, we did short rib, and we did, it was sort of like a like a, we called it like a Christmas dinner.
Mm.
So it was a braised short rib, and then we put like a pan fried potato cake in there too.
Mm.
And then we grated like a ton of horseradish over the top of it.
Wow.
Yeah.
When you make it, let me know.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a really popular one. It was good.
Mm. So what does hapa mean?
Hapa means half in Hawaiian. It's actually like, some people consider it like a derogatory term. Like you call someone like you're not full Hawaiian, you're hapa, you know, that's like, that's old. It's come to be like embraced by people who are mixed ethnicity, mostly people who are half Asian, but it can refer to like anyone really that's half and half, or even, you know, like not half and half, like kids, my kids are a quarter Asian, so they call themselves kwapa. So yeah, I mean, it means half, and it was representative of the style of food that I was doing, because I wasn't doing strictly Japanese food. It was Japanese flavors and a Japanese dish, but through the lens of like all this other technique and experience that I had had.
Mm.
So it was sort of a half Japanese thing. Mm. So, and also bringing it back to being inspired by Saimin and then like the Hawaiian culture and things like that.
Mm. So that's really exciting about this whole American mindset. Like, if you go to Japan, it's still very traditional, and it's kind of, you are feeling you're prohibited from being too creative.
Right. I mean, I definitely think that especially Asian American cooks have done some, like, really interesting stuff. And, like, in, you know, Danny at Mission Chinese probably being, like, the leader of that, of taking the food. But, I mean, like, Brandon Ju at Mr. Ju's in San Francisco's, you know, he opened this Chinese restaurant, like modern Chinese restaurant in Chinatown. It's like very bold move, and you know, he received a Michelin star this year for that. So there's a lot of cool stuff happening out there.
Okay, so what is the unique about your ramen? Like, you know, you said it's creative, but I heard that you were really into, you know, using organic farmers' produce or those things, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that starting there, just the ingredients were different.
Mm.
And that we were in a farmer's market serving our food.
Mm.
So we had really deep connections with all the people that supplied us with our food.
It's in the farmer's market. That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, we would feed them, you know, and we would kind of like go down to their stand and they'd be like, hey, I saved you a case of this, you know. And then we would feature that at the next market that we did.
Right.
So it was using really great vegetables that were in season, trying to make everything from scratch, using whole animals for all the butchery that we did and for all the meats that we used, which became hard because one day we would have pork belly and the next day we would have pork shoulder and the next day we would have like a confit pork leg. And there would always be someone that came and be like, hey, do you guys have like belly today? And be like, no, we have the shoulder. And they're like, oh man. And then another person come like the next day, they'd be like, oh, do you guys have the shoulder today? And be like, no, we have the leg. So, yeah. So that made it really different. And then just, we took a lot of risks and did a lot of just kind of weird stuff, and really like played around and tried to like push ourselves and do different flavors in the ramen.
Like what?
Okay. I mean, we did a really, really elegant Meyer lemon and chicken broth, and the noodles had Meyer lemon in them.
Wow.
For an event that I did in Texas, I did huckleberry noodles that were smoked. I smoked the flour and then put dehydrated huckleberry into them, and then did that with a duck broth. And then we did like lowbrow stuff. We did a cheeseburger ramen one time, which is that beef broth, and it had like skune, but had the skune had was beef, and it had
like a basically ground beef.
Yeah, and it had cheese in it.
Mm.
You know, we did silly stuff like that, and it had like charred lettuce and everything in it. So
that makes sense.
Yeah, it was good. You know, and it was sort of like, because there was the ramen burger then. And so we did cheeseburger, like bringing it back the other way. So yeah, and then like making noodles and things like that, found that we could like incorporate a lot of flavor into the liquid that we hydrated the flour with. So you could season that liquid to make a flavored noodle. Like if you wanted to, you know, you could make like a shrimp stock and hydrate the noodle with shrimp stock and then add like dried ground shrimp into it to make like a really good shrimp noodle.
So it's a built-in shrimp flavor.
Right. Right. Which I feel like is something that people still aren't really doing with their ramen noodles, is like flavoring the noodles themselves, you know?
It's really hard though to make. I mean, it's like, you know, sun noodle. and Kenshiro Oki came here and talked about his noodles. And people looking for customization, because it's by yourself, it's very hard.
Right.
Too much work to do.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's the funny thing. Like, tons of people will ask about a ramen place. They go, oh, do they make their own noodles? And I'm like, that's not really a thing. Like, places don't really make their noodles, but there's this image in a lot of people's head of like the ramen chef, you know, like hand cutting the noodles every day. And I'm like, that's not really a thing that, that a lot of ramen chefs do. Mm. Most of them buy in their noodles,
right?
Which is not a, I mean, some noodles are like the best, you know? And if you can't make them as good as they make them, then like, why do it? You know? But, we took a lot of pride in taking on like trying to incorporate all these flavors into the noodle and just doing different stuff, different shapes, things like that, you know?
Right. Yeah, that's, I think, the different mindset between ramen chefs, which is really almost Zen mindset about dashi and soup and stuff versus, you know, incorporating the creativity into noodles, which is beyond their mindset.
Well, I mean, it really drives your costs up too, you know? So the more that you do, you know, these really nice ingredients, so that you're doing a whole animal that maybe 1 year costs you $4 a pound, the next year the farmer has to raise his prices to $1.50 for you, things like that. And then making everything from scratch, so you have a lot of labor. It drives up the price for your guest, and they have this idea in their head that a bowl of ramen should be like $9, you know? And then they come and you're charging, you know, maybe $18 for it, you know? So the perception of value can sometimes be hard to get across until they understand that, like, how much thought has gone into this bowl and how we did all these different little things.
Right. It's not fair.
It's not fair. I mean, David Chang's talked about that a lot, about how ramen shouldn't cost less than like a bowl of pasta costs in an Italian restaurant, but it does. It has to, you know, because of the public's idea of what it is.
Right.
But I mean, like, for the most like deluxe bowl of ramen we served, I weighed it one day and it weighed like 3 pounds. It's like, it's too much food, you know? And I was like, for 3 pounds of food and for like what we charge, like, it's really like a good value, you know? So.
Right. And also that uniqueness, you cannot get it anywhere else.
Right. Right. Yeah. And it was definitely, I think we definitely hit like a nice niche of people. The customers that became like our most loyal customers were people who hadn't eaten ramen before. They would just start coming to our stand. And that was their first experience with ramen.
So it was a very strategic, you know, location, that it's not the ramen shop and it's part of the farmer's market.
Yeah, yeah. And luckily, San Francisco is generally very cold, you know, I mean, relatively to New York. But, you know, we're down on the waterfront. We're there, you know, in the morning into like the early afternoon. So it's usually like pretty foggy and like kind of like damp outside. And we had this like nice warming thing that we could give to people. And then, yeah, we're amongst like all the farms and everything.
Right.
But also, like, it's changed a little bit down at that market. But the vendors that were there were also very high quality vendors in what they did. You know, like 4505 Meats was there and Pizza Politano was there. And Namugaji was there doing like really great Korean food. So it wasn't like your normal farmer's market, like go get a thing of like kettle corn and walk around. Like, you could really like eat a great lunch there.
So destination.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I wish there's a similar one in New York City.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about Rich's unique ramen recipes. So please stay with us.
This is the story of men and women who shed not only their clothes, but also their...
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katema, and my guest today is Richie Nakano, who is a chef based in San Francisco and a former chef and founder of Hapa Ramen that was known for unique and umami-rich delicious ramen. So we'll talk about your original ramen in a moment, but for listeners who are not familiar with ramen, could you tell us the basic components of ramen?
It's noodles, broth, a piece of chashu, mm-hmm. and sometimes an egg. And I mean, traditionally they'll put menma in it.
The fermented bamboo shoot, right?
Yeah. Mm. Some places put like a little ball of like blanched spinach in there. And then, you know, depending on the style you get, there'll be some sort of flavored oil in there usually.
Right. Well, that I really want to hear because, you know, we know dashi and soup and tari. We just kind of mix the whole terms, mm-hmm. right? So as far as I understand, there's a soup. That's right. The liquid we see in the bowl. Mm-hmm. And can you break down what it's made of?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to do that. Some places do a double soup where they add in dashi and they add in stock, mm-hmm. you know. Some places add in like a lot of like dried fish right into the bowl.
Mm-hmm.
So it varies from place to place and recipe to recipe, but the stock itself is generally pork.
Mm-hmm.
And you're using any mixture of pork neck bones, pork trotters.
Mm.
Some places use the head.
Mm-hmm.
Like I knew a guy who would make a stock out of 20 heads.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really weird.
Mm.
But it was great. His stock was really good. Some places have you blanching the bones to get all the blood off of them, so you get a very like clean, like white stock.
Right.
And some places roast the bones, and some places add a little bit of chicken in there, some places don't. And then there's a ton of different ways to do it. You can, if you're going to use dashi, you can make dashi separately.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen places, and I've done myself, where we would make the pork stock itself. We would take all the bones out, and then we would throw in kombu.
Mm.
And just steep it in there for a couple hours.
Okay.
Pull the kombu and then add in bonito, steep that in there for a little while, and then pull it out.
Right.
And then would strain the stock.
Mm. So when you say stock, basically, bone-based or maybe sometimes vegetable?
Yeah, we did a vegetarian stock that was basically like a kombu miso stock.
Mm.
So kombu, pull that out. We would add in a lot of vegetables, onions, carrots, garlic, ginger, and then we would just let that go for 30 minutes or so, and then we would add in a lot of shiro miso.
Okay.
And then we would take like a roasted vegetable in season, make a puree out of that, and then fold that into the stock.
Oh, wow. So that's very original.
Yeah. So like in the fall, we would do like a butternut squash stock, you know.
Wow.
Yeah, it was good.
Right. Because I think in Japan, people say dashi, and I think there's tare, which I'm going to ask you now. But the dashi plus tare is the soup.
Right.
And so that what is tare?
So tare is taking shoyu, usually garlic, ginger, sugar, sometimes sake, mirin, sometimes water even, to thin it down. And you can make a basic tare out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to sort of go in a different direction, some people like to put bones into the tare itself to kind of fortify that. Japanese places will take grilled bones and will put them in there to get like a smoky flavor into the tare.
Right.
So, and then you can use that for seasoning ramen. You can use it for you know, cooking your chashu in. There's a ton of different applications for it. You know, if you reduce the tare, you can use it for yakitori glaze, like all sorts of things.
Okay, so basically, you separate dashi stock part and tare, because tare is more like concentrated accent.
Yeah, I mean, that's where all your seasoning is going to come from, is really the tare.
Okay.
And then you can even finish it off with some sort of like seasoned salt or something like that at the end, just to give it like a little bit of a boost. You know?
So you have, as a ramen chef, you have to come up with two unique parts, like dashi stock and the tare.
Yeah, and you have to, and they all have to be balanced. You know, you can't have one that really like knocks out the other one, or else there's no point in even including that other component.
Right.
So making like a really intense dashi that has like a lot of bonito in it, it becomes really important, you know, making sure your tare doesn't over reduce and become acrid is really important. And then making sure your stock is nice and clean, and like you've gotten all the fat out of it and everything that didn't like emulsify into the liquid. That's a really important step too. So,
because it affects the mouthfeel of the noodles too.
Yeah. I mean, like I've definitely had bowls of ramen where there's like an inch of fat on the top of the bowl,
right.
You know, and some people like that, you know, like the Kotari style ramen, but it's real rich.
You can eat it every day.
Right.
For sure. Right. And also there is a flavored oil. So how does it work?
I mean, you just take oil, and there's a ton of different oils you can make. You can make garlic oil, chili oil, you know, black garlic oil, which is basically not like fermented garlic, but just burnt garlic. But you burn it very, very slowly. So it doesn't become like super acrid and bitter. It takes on almost like a coffee-like flavor to it. I've seen chefs make shrimp oils, chicken oils by taking like chicken wings and frying them in oil. So, there's a lot of different oils you can use, you know.
So it's another source of creativity.
Right. And it's also just a way of using up stuff if you have it around the kitchen, you know. Like the shrimp oil we just made from shrimp shells, if you were using shrimp in another dish in your restaurant, things like that.
Okay. So you put the oil, like sprinkle at the end?
Usually, so the traditional pickup for ramen is soup in first. And so you'll see the chef working there, and they have their stock, they have their tare, they have dashi, they have a little bit of flavored oil, they maybe have like a powder or some sort that they're adding in there. And you'll see them add them all in, and everything's measured, you know, according to the ladle size that they want. And then at the end, they'll put in the noodles, fluff the noodles a little bit, and then garnish goes on top. We did it differently. We would always do noodles down first, and then soup, and then build the garnish on top. And I'm not sure why we did that, but it just became to be the way that we made our soup, you know.
Maybe it's for presentation, it's easier to control the shape of the noodle the way you did.
I think that was part of it, and then also just in terms of the way we did the stock at the market, we couldn't have like 30 different little banes of stuff around. We had like a 10 foot table that we would work on.
Right.
So we were limited in space there.
Right. Okay. So now the ramen itself that you made, so most classic ramen dishes, soy, salt, miso, that's I think the three basic. But what kind of ramen did you serve at Hapa Ramen?
I mean, it was the vegetarian stock was that rotating one that, you know, just from season to season, it would change. Like in the summertime, it would be a corn broth with miso. In the fall, it would be butternut squash with miso. In the spring, we could feature vegetables in there. And it would be like very just tons of different vegetables in as the garnish. It would be a light miso broth. And then we would take like green garlic and make like a green garlic sesame oil to put on top of it. So it's sort of that one swayed through the seasons and sort of changed and everything. Although we'd get people that would come by and would say, like it would be like July, and they'd be like, "Do you have the butternut squash broth?" And we'd be like, "No." And then the Hapa Ramen broth is that one that we constantly kept changing and refining and everything. And honestly, like for the first month that we were making that, it wasn't very good, I don't think, you know, like looking back on it now, because it was a recipe I took out of my kitchen in my home and tried to scale. So instead of making it for 10 people at home, I was all of a sudden making it for like 400 people. And scaling it was really hard, you know.
And especially in the limited space.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I mean, and we tried to make that broth just a complete collaborative effort in terms of like all the cooks that worked there. And pretty much everyone that worked at Hapa, I've stayed really close with, and they're like family to me now, you know. And they all played as big a hand in like the development of that stock as I think I did. Because, you know, after a while, they were the ones that were making it from day to day. So, yeah. So, I mean, like it went through a lot of different incarnations, but the main basis of it was a pork stock with a little bit of chicken in it, with really, really intensely cooked vegetables in it, with tare in it. By the end of it, we weren't putting dashi in it anymore. We tried to have like the flavor of those charred vegetables with the tare, and then just the flavor of the soup sort of be the main focus.
So you don't need the cured items like a bonito or strong flavors.
We always had that stuff around, and we used it in a lot of different stuff. And there were years of Hapa Ramen where there was dashi in the stock, you know. But I think we got to this point where we were looking at the soup and we were saying, like, how can we, like, strip this down to, like, what its core essence should be? And I think that there was, going the other way, there was times during it where we were like, oh, this should have, like, more of this or more of that, you know. And kind of, like, let ourselves, like, run with it a little too much, you know. So, but by the end of our run, we had reeled it back in and being this real tight, concise dish.
So, this is more.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
Right. And by the way, I have, I found a recipe, one of your signature dishes. I think it's called the Big Daddy Ramen.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about that because it really sounds fascinating. And you made, of course, noodles by yourself. And for, you know, it's not the classic recipe. And you used the baking soda, not the kanse. Kanse is alkaline kind of sodium liquid. And then also used the semolina and eggs in noodles. So why all those three different components?
I mean, it was just taking, you know, making that. But so back then, that was a really hard time. That recipe is from the first year that we were in business. And I was making those noodles every day. And we were making it on the small little Imperia pasta maker. Like, we didn't have like a commercial ramen machine, you know? And so to make enough noodles for service, it was about 8 hours of like straight work. And you had to just keep going and like sheeting them out and then cutting them and then drying them and sheeting them out and cutting them and drying them. You had to have like a really good rhythm to it. You could like barely stop to go to the bathroom. But in terms of the development of that recipe, it was what I made at home using like the techniques I'd used to make pasta and just trying to like carry them across into ramen, you know? And I never had anyone show me how to make ramen noodles before. So it was just me like making a recipe at home and seeing like, oh, this works and they taste good. As time went on, like once we started making the noodles like on a commercial ramen machine, a lot of that stuff changed. Like we realized that you had to have a lot less moisture in the noodle. So eggs would be subbed out for egg powder, you know, things like that. And then we would use a really, really dry, really high protein Japanese flour to dust them with so they would stay nice and dry. So as time went on, like the recipe changed and things sort of like dropped off. In the beginning, it was mostly just like not knowing how to do it any other way to keep them from sticking or to get flavor into them, you know.
But I really like this creativity. Like, you worked out.
It was so it was me and a friend of mine that I worked with at NOPA would come over, and we had the same day off every week, and we would just stand in my kitchen and we would make noodles like over and over and over again, make this recipe and that recipe, and then take notes about them and eat them and just sort of see what we thought. But I mean, neither one of us really knew what we were doing, and then we did a pop up. And he ended up having to sheet out like 500 portions of noodles. And he did it over the course of 2 days. And like, I've never seen a guy work so hard on like the tiniest little pasta machine. But yeah.
Wow.
So it was just like a lot of experimentation and playing around with it.
Right. So I'm sure it's contributes to your current noodles too.
Yeah. I mean, and also just the stories of like those days of just being in front of that machine all day. There's a picture out there somewhere of us doing it, and we had this most like rickety setup. It was like we would take like 2 8-quart containers and turn them over, and then there'd be like a rod that we would tape on there, and that's what we'd use to dry the noodles. And there'd be like trays stacked up with like the noodles going into them and their little bundles and everything. And then there was this flour everywhere. You know. So
Okay. And the other thing I noticed that you used sous vide, which is basically a vacuum-packed, temperature-controlled, high-tech cooking method, mm-hmm. which wouldn't be found in Japanese traditional ramen right. restaurant. So what's the benefit of using? I think you use this for, as far as I know, pork shoulder and the egg as well.
Yeah, so we would cook all the eggs. And I mean, honestly, this using sous vide for us was a way to cook a large volume of food all in one shot and know that it would all come out exactly the same.
Mm.
And so if you think about the market, if we sold 400 bowls of ramen and, you know, just half of those people got an egg, if we were, you know, soft cooking the egg and then had to peel all of them and then cut all of them, like it would add so much work onto our day. And it was a way for us to offer our guests, honestly, like most of them had never had one of an egg out of a circulator before. And we could offer them a whole egg instead of like a half an egg that a lot of ramen shops gave. And then in terms of the chashu, it was just trying to like find a way that we could do it all in one shot and get all the pork cooked for the next day.
Right.
And make sure it would all come out the same and know exactly when to be done. So it wasn't really a thing where I was using sous vide because I thought that it was like a better cooking method. I mean, honestly, like I think that if you can braise your chashu in tare, that's the best way to do it. And we would kind of like do like a cheating way of doing that by putting tare in the vacuum sealed bag with it and then would circulate it in there, you know? But even when you do it that way, it doesn't get like super caramelized the way like a really good piece of chashu does. So yeah, we just kind of like did it that way. And then for other things, like if we did like turoniku, like the braised jowl, I would do that stovetop. Because I think I could get like more flavor into it, you know? And then like we'd take that and like grill that over Japanese charcoal. So we had like these other chashus we would do that were more traditional methods, but for the chashu we served like every day and it had to go in every single bowl, we pretty much had to do it in the circulator.
I mean, I thought it was really a good idea for consistency, which is very hard, especially ramen shops. They tend to have high turns.
Well, and I think you go to a lot of ramen shops and you get a piece of chashu and it can be pretty dry. You know,
that's so sad.
You know, especially if a place uses like pork loin or something like that for their chashu, like those pieces are always so like chalky and dry.
So you like dip, you know, soak in the soup and they get moist.
That's very sad. Because you're having this like very rich, like velvety stock and like these great chewy noodles, and there's this like dry, like cardboardy thing in there.
Okay, so sous vide may be a good way to solve the problem.
I mean, like when we get at the restaurant, we had a combi oven, like a steam oven. So every single night, we would, you know, get that thing going and would put the pork in. And like last thing, like basically at midnight, you know, get it going. And then the person that came in at 8 a.m. would pull it out and would chill it and then would cut it. So, and that was basically the way we would do it with the circulators. But I was telling a friend yesterday, we broke so many circulators over the years because we were circulating such a giant volume of water. And they're not really meant to do that. They're meant to like circulate this little tiny volume of water at like a fine dining restaurant. So yeah, we killed a lot of immersion circulators over the years.
But they worked.
It's
hard for you. So you eventually opened a brick and mortar version of Happy Ramen, which fortunately closed in March 2015. So over that 5 years, did you see the change in customers' palate of ramen?
Definitely. Like I was saying, like a lot of people would come to us and be like, I've never even had ramen before. And then they would eat our ramen. And there were people that came in the beginning and didn't like it. And they would come back like 2 years later and they'd be like, oh man, it's like, it's so good. So it was interesting to see people, especially as like ramen culture sort of like pervaded in San Francisco, to how people would come to us, and most of the time they'd be like, oh, this is really cool, it's something different, you know, and you guys are doing something really neat. I mean, other people hated it, you know, because they wanted like a very traditional style of ramen, you know. But I mean, for the most part, we had very loyal customers and a very, very intense loyal following, which was great. And really at the restaurant, like we really started to like hit our stride in terms of like doing different dishes, experimenting, seeing what had worked in the past and everything. So, you know, it kind of sucked. Like when the restaurant closed, we were really like hitting our stride in terms of like being confident about what we were doing and like putting out a really great, like exciting product.
Mm.
So I feel like I got stopped short a little bit, but, yeah, I mean, and I think people just became more and more open to like the crazy kind of stuff we were doing with the bowls, you know?
Interesting. So it's almost sounds like, you know, sushi starting from Dragon Balls and then going up to Sirius.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, well, that's the thing is like the food was, you know, very, I think there's a, like an elegance to a lot of it, but we really tried not to take ourselves too seriously. You know, we wanted to have fun with the food and for it to be approachable. I mean, like both of my children basically grew up eating ramen. And so like seeing the way that they would eat it and the way they enjoyed it, I always tried to keep that in my frame of mind in terms of the way that like I approached it, you know.
You don't want to be nervous when you eat something.
Yeah. You know, I never wanted the base of what I was making to be something they wouldn't eat, you know?
Right.
So there were certain dishes like I would put on garnishes and they didn't want that kind of stuff. But as long as the base soup was good and the pork was good and the noodles were good and they would be into it, I try to always keep that in my focus.
Right. Great. So what are you working on right now and what's your next plan?
So I've been doing a thing with my friend back in San Francisco that we call IDK, which stands for I don't know. And it's just like a little pop-up thing that we do. And our friend Maya, who's up in Portland, is involved in it also. And it's basically just like a very non-serious, like anti-pop-up. And we try to make it really approachable for people who live in the neighborhood where we do it. We try to make it affordable. So far we've done like an all chicken pop-up. We did like a sort of like a traditional Italian restaurant pop-up with like eggplant parmesan and like lasagna and ziti and things like that. And coming into the end of this month and then rolling into February, we're going to go back to doing another ramen pop-up, which is going to be the first one that we've done since, I don't know, like last year, sometime like mid last year.
Right.
And then roll off that one into like a pot pie pop-up. We're going to do a pan pizza pop-up and then roll back into doing ramen again. So yeah, it's kind of getting back into doing that. And yeah, it's doing a lot of writing and things like that. I'm trying to see my kids more.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good time. Very important.
Yeah.
Right. So do you think you're going to eventually open another ramen restaurant?
The other day my son came up to me and he goes like, I wish you had a restaurant again. And I was like, yeah, me too. I want to. It's just San Francisco is so expensive, you know. I mean, to open a place there is about a minimum $1 million, you know, and it's really hard to find workers there. Cost of ingredients is really high. It's hard. It's just hard to make it a sustainable business,
right.
You know? So I want to, I just think that in terms of where in the city it was and, you know, how I structured the business in terms of like, is it a restaurant? Is it like a really fast casual place? Like, what is the model there? All of those would come into consideration.
Right.
And I think right now isn't the right time because I think San Francisco is about to go through a pretty big downturn in terms of restaurants. You know, like a lot of restaurants are kind of hurting there right now.
Okay.
So kind of wait it out, you know. I have no intention.
Because the restaurants are kind of burnt out for the cost and a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of like high-profile places opened in the last year, and a lot of them closed, you know. I mean, like really expensive, like multi-million dollar restaurants kind of like came and went very quickly.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of the people that live there now can eat lunch or dinner for free at their work. They have a giant cafeteria that, you know, has a lot of great chefs and cooks working at it.
Right.
You know, like Google, Facebook, Twitter, they all have that.
Right.
So that's kind of hurting restaurants a lot. And then, you know, like meal delivery stuff is sort of hurting restaurants a lot. So I'm going to kind of wait it out and sort of see what happens.
It's interesting because diners' lifestyle, I mean, if they go to expensive restaurant, they don't want to be kind of served, like treated as someone special.
Right.
It's more like you share and have a kind of conversation casually and just like an extension of the dining room.
Right, right.
So maybe, I don't know, you may not need a restaurant.
Yeah, maybe not. I mean, I don't know, doing the pop-up thing now has been fun. And doing it, because, you know, we did pop-ups while we were running the farmer's market stand, and it was fun then, but it added a lot of pressure onto our week, because we're already serving, you know, anywhere from 900 to 1200 bowls of ramen in that short time span. And then we would throw like a couple events on top of that. And doing it now without having the market and having like a little more freedom and a little more like time and being able to kind of like dip and dive with what we're doing on the menu has made it really fun. It's very refreshing, like creatively. It's been refreshing.
Nice.
So we want to keep going with that for right now.
Okay. So, just a quick last question about the ramen. So, you know, ramen became, I think, a part of American diet. And what do you see as the future of ramen? Is going to stay popular or could be, I don't know, some different form of ramen?
I think it's going to stay popular. I think it needs to evolve. I think that people need to stop being so obsessed with like tonkotsu and things like that, because that really seems like the prevailing trend right now is like tonkotsu and like really heavy stocks.
Nice.
So I'd love to see people sort of like getting over that. It's like when bacon was really popular, it was like, put bacon on everything. That's what tonkotsu feels like to me, you know? So I'd love to see the ramen culture move beyond that and people get into more like shoyu style and, you know, things like that, like lighter styles.
Because you used to have a vegetarian ramen too, right?
Yeah. And I'd love to see, I'd love to see people do more stuff with vegetarian ramen than just doing like a shiitake stock. Then I'd just love to see like diners' opinions about ramen change in terms of thinking that it's like a cheap food. It's not. It's not cheap to produce at all.
Right. That was like 50 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So good luck.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So thank you for joining us, and then keep us posted.
I will.
Okay. So where can we find your latest activities update?
Oh, I mean, so I'm on Twitter and Instagram at LineCook, just all one word. And then our pop-up is on Twitter and Instagram at IDK Concepts.
Okay. Well, I have to check that out.
Yeah.
Okay. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for guests or topics of the show, please contact us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org. And Japan Needs is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, and Stitcher Podcasts. Today's show is made possible by Corin, and our engineer is Vitro Hash. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.